five stars across the board. This is in fact cited in critical literature as being one of these examples of a book written about what appears to be a very boring topic, which is absolutely fascinating. People say the most amazing things about this book, like, my God, I couldn't put it down. What I'm hoping to accomplish today is to do something similar. I want to talk to you about a topic that might not seem fascinating right off the top of your head, and which I hope I'm going to convince you is. So my topic is state estimation, which, well, a common response is, okay, state estimation, tomography, right? Moving on. And the first thing that I hope to convince you of is, no, it's not that simple. I'm also going to try to fold in another topic, which is quantum scoring rules. And so these are two separate papers. The earlier paper on quantum scoring rules is joint work with Patrick Hayden. And I'm also going to, if I get time, present some numerical results at the end that were done with summer student Karan Malhotra from India Institute of Technology at Kanpur. In way of introducing what the heck I'm talking about, let me start out by pointing out what is quantum state estimation. This is a very, very basic procedure for quantum computing, quantum information theory, and in fact, I would say for physics in general, well, at least if you think of physics as quantum physics, your goal is to characterize a source of quantum systems, something where you push a button, and every time you push the button, it spits out a quantum system that's prepared in some state. You don't know what that state is. You're going to assume that each state is identically and independently distributed. So blah, 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 deep and eddy, for those of you who like to think about this sort of thing. And you're going to make measurements on n separate copies. I want this to be relevant to people actually working in laboratories right now, so I'm not going to assume any powerful ability to make joint measurements on all n copies or anything like that. You're going to get some measurement record, which is a series of POVM effects. These are positive operators describing your outcome. And at the end of the day, you're going to report your best guess for what the state that describes all of these quantum systems is. Since this is a quantum information talk, the key application that I want to highlight is verifying quantum hardware. The idea being that we're going to build states and gates, which are going to be put together to form a quantum computer eventually. Fault tolerance thresholds generally rely on the components working to within some threshold that, depending on who you ask, might be as high as 5%, might be as low as 10 to the minus 8, and you could probably put a couple of standard deviations in the 10 to the minus 3, 10 to the minus 5 range. So the thing that I'd like you to keep in mind is that probabilities of errors on the order of 10 to the minus 3 or perhaps even less are extremely relevant. So getting it vaguely correct is really not good enough. For those of you who have a foundations bent, I have two things to say. The first is, although I haven't written it down here, the relevance of this is how we find out about the natural world. If you do theory on quantum systems, you say, well, this is what ought to happen, and I have confidence that it does. Somebody had better go out and test this. And so, if you want to figure out what the state of a quantum system is, you have to do something like this. You have to make measurements. Those measurements don't tell you the state. You have to infer the state from that. The other thing that I want to say to the foundations people is, if you have any really complicated questions involving the word deep and eddy or propensity, please leave them until the end. Are there any other questions at this point? Okay, clarification questions, please, please do ask me. Don't allow me to blitz on without explaining something. Couple of points up front. First of all, state estimation procedures all consist of, first of all, a rule for making measurements, and then a rule for analyzing the data. With reference to the oranges thing, I'm actually going to talk about what appears to be the boring part, which is how do you analyze the data. Again, I hope it's not going to be as boring as oranges might be. Finally, every same procedure for doing quantum state estimation works the same when you go to infinitely many copies. If you had two procedures that gave you different reports after you had measured infinitely many copies, one of them would not be same. Well, at least one of them. So I'm interested in where the number of measurements you've made is somewhere between 1 and infinity. Specifically, you can't approximate it as either 1 or infinity. Okay, now what I'm going to say. First of all, I'm going to start off by motivating what I'm talking about by pointing out that current state estimation protocols are a disaster in some circumstances. They make you say really embarrassing things. The second thing I'm going to do is outline a foundation for how to fix this problem. This is quantum scoring rules, which is a rather interesting bit of theory on its own. Finally, I'm going to present what I think is a solution to this problem, which is Bayesian mean estimation. And this is in the most recent paper on the archive. And tell you about some of the features and why it's really, really good. And finally, if I have some time, I'm going to present numerical comparisons for simulated experiments between different procedures. And there's a bit of an Easter egg hidden here, something that I haven't referred to, which is quite startling. So, okay, first of all, let's talk about motivation. What is the problem here? Current technology for state estimation is called maximum likelihood estimation. I'll talk a little bit more about it later. The basic idea is you've got this measurement record consisting of a series of POVM effects that you've observed. And from that, you compute what's called a likelihood function. This is going to show up several times throughout my talk. It's a distillation of everything that's relevant about your data. And it's simply the probability of getting the data that you observed given a state rho. So this is a function of rho, and it's defined for every possible state that could describe your system. And from that likelihood function, you end up with an estimate, rho sub MLA, which is in fact the maximum of the likelihood function. And that's what you report. So this is what we've been doing for the last couple of years. The problem is this doesn't accurately represent what the experimentalist knows about the system they've measured. The reason is, typically, which is to say virtually all the time, this density matrix has some zero eigenvalues. There's some pure states, so that the overlap between that pure state and the density matrix that you report in your paper is zero. Well, a zero eigenvalue is a zero probability for some measurement outcome corresponding to the projectron of this pure state. Problem is, zero probability means absolute certainty, which means you can't have any error bars on this. Now, let me talk more about this in just a moment. But first, I'd like to point out this is not some fantasy that I've come up with. This is probably the most cited paper, 800 by 600, ouch. This is probably the most cited paper that I know of on state estimation. It's a PRA from 2001, and this was worked on by Polkia, Andrew White, Daniel James, a lot of theory. I honestly don't know what Bowman Rowe is doing in here, but it was probably something useful. And this is the density matrix for a two-photon state. So if you're looking at the polarization state of two photons produced by parametric down conversion. So they use state estimation to do a whole bunch of measurements. This is the density matrix they come up with. It's quite complicated. But they handily compute the eigenvalues. So this is taken from the paper. The eigenvalues of this are 0.986, 0.014, 0, and 0. Just 0.
I mean, are you going to expand on what you said on the last slide about not zero, not admitting any error?
Absolutely.
But, Rob?
Yes?
May I ask you, I mean, it's a, say, 0.986, so that basically means this plus minus exponents.
Right.
I mean, and if they say zero, doesn't it just mean, well, zero plus some small error? I mean, they know for sure what, it's probably not minus, but they also know what, it might be some plus error.
Absolutely. Tell you what, if I haven't answered your question in 10 minutes, ask me again. Is that fair?
Okay.
Really, 1128. Okay, so this was back in 2001, and maybe we fixed it all since then. So this is a more recent paper. This is a Nature paper from December of 2005 by the Innsbruck group on ion trapping. This is a really neat paper. What they did is they produced or tried to produce a W state, which has entanglement among all the ions in their trap for 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8 ions. So a qubit, if you will. This got rather a lot of attention on Slashdot. So what I've done here is I've taken the density matrices that were reported and which they used to compute the value of an entanglement witness to tell them whether there was entanglement or not, and I've plotted the histogram of eigenvalues of those density matrices. About 10 to the 6th measurements were made, and I've drawn a line here at 10 to the minus 6, so 1 over n. The red points here, red peaks, correspond to eigenvalues that are less than 1 in 10 to the minus, sorry, 1 in 10 to the 6, which are, I would say, pretty close to 0. If you like, this big peak down here is ones that are literally 0. And you'll notice there's a whole lot of red in these histograms. The point is, even as of last year, we still have this problem. We're still reporting 0 eigenvalues, and in fact, quite a few of them. So we might ask what's going on here. Now, as to Florian's question, well, error bars. First comment here is usually, well, there's error bars in there, right? Okay, the first answer is not always. It's not quite hard to figure out what the error bars ought to be, and it's even harder to report them in a lot of cases. So let me focus on a more fundamental question. what does saying that a probability is zero plus or minus some amount mean? As was pointed out, probably, I know that the probability is not less than zero, which is useful information. So if I think of p equals 0 plus or minus 0.1 as meaning, well, this is the probability distribution that I ascribe to p, then I can optimize, I can get better than this. I can take that area, and I can get rid of it, because I know that it's not there. But then I look at this distribution, and a better interpretation of that distribution would be saying, well, the probability is some small positive number, plus or minus some other small positive number. I've reduced my uncertainty in the estimate by taking advantage of the fact that I know it's not negative. Now, those are just sort of, you know, made up numbers. But my point is, you can get a better estimate by putting the middle of your estimate over here, putting your error bars on either side of it. Okay, so this is a great idea. The question I want to ask, though, is given that increasing small probabilities means that you have to decrease the large ones in order to keep track of normalization, what effect does that have if you have to fix 218 zero eigenvalues in a 256-dimensional state? Well, let me actually consider that in a little more detail. Here's the density matrix that was reported in that Nature paper. There's a large eigenvalue of about 3/4, and this is basically corresponding to the projector onto the W state they were trying to produce. So you want to think of this large eigenvalue as being good. It tells you you have an entangled state, which allows you to write a Nature paper. Then there's a couple of other noise ones, and then there's a whole bunch of zeros down here. So we've argued that these zeros should actually be epsilons. We should fix those up a little bit. That would be a better description of the state. The question is, what is epsilon? It's a function of the number of measurements. Well, what's the number of measurements? Well, we've got about 7 times 10 to the 5th measurements in this experiment, individual clicks of the detector. But there are 65,000 independent components of the density matrix, each of which is a real number, and you're trying to estimate it. On the other hand, there were about 6,500 different settings of the apparatus used, and about 256 different eigenvalues. So how many measurements per number did we do? Which of these numbers is the valid number of parameters? So what is n? Perhaps n is in fact 7 times 10 to the 5th, in which case I fix these up to order 10 to the minus 6, and really I don't have much of an effect up there. But that seems like a very generous assumption to make. So let me consider if I divide up my clicks amongst the different eigenvalues. Now n is about 2,500. If I set my fudge factors to be 10 to the minus 3, which is 1 over n, I've changed my large eigenvalue from 0.75 to 0.61, which has a nasty effect on whether I violate an entangled witness or not. On the other hand, it might be even worse. I might say, well, n is the number of clicks per different measurement setting, in which case n is only about 100, and again, 1 over n gives me 10 to the minus 2, and now that eigenvalue has dropped to 0.23, and I'm not even going to try to do any calculations for it if it's measurements per independent component of the density matrix. There's also a question, should epsilon be 1 over n or should it be 1 over root n? I've taken the most generous assumption, but you might want to say that it's 1 over root n, in which case things get even worse. So what I'm trying to convey here is this is a bit of a mess. We don't know what n is. We don't know what epsilon is. We're not even sure how to estimate this uncertainty. And finally, we don't know what effect that has on the thing that we report at the end of the day. So you should be feeling slightly adrift at the moment, which is the same feeling that my friend Mouser and I had about a year ago in Colorado when we went hiking and discovered we accidentally climbed the wrong mountain. In some sense, we set out in this talk to climb the mountain of what state did we have, and we ended up in this weird morass of what do these numbers mean. We wanted to be over there. Yes?
I don't understand. Why aren't you saying it was 0.74 plus or minus that same epsilon, and those errors have to somehow obey the normalization rule?
Because of the statement, those errors have to somehow obey. That doesn't work. The reason is that you have plus or minus, if you put a plus or minus on the big eigenvalue, but you put pluses only, as Laurie pointed out, you can't have minus on all the small eigenvalues, then that's not self-consistent.
Why not? Because the error could be anywhere in between zero and epsilon.
So let me give you
you're saying they can't all be the maximum epsilon.
Let me give you an extreme example.
Okay.
Suppose that I have concluded the probabilities were 1, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0, 0. But then I say, well, I'm uncertain to about 10%. So all of my small ones could be bigger. If I now say, well, you know, the error in my large one, right, it's just it's 1 minus maybe 10%. The problem is each of my zeros could be bigger by up to 0.1. The only way that that's consistent with saying it's 1, possibly minus 0.1, is if the uncertainty in each of the small ones is actually a heck of a lot smaller. There's no way that I can have uncertainty of 0.1, one side of uncertainty, in all of the zeros and in the single bit one.
Depends on the distribution of the uncertainty and how they're correlated.
It does, but they have to be correlated. I mean, there is simply no way that I can have 100 eigenvalues, each of which is somewhere between 0 and 0.1, and another one, which is somewhere between 1 and 0.9.
Well, you can. You're saying it's not a realistic distribution. They could all just be 0.
No, I guess the point is if you have, like, a correlation where of those 99 things, one of them is 0.1 and the others are all 0, the thing is that will give you an uncertainty on a single one that's, like, much smaller than 0.1 because 99% of the time, or, yeah, it's still 0, right?
So maybe this is a good offline topic, but I'll argue if you want later on that it's sort of this problem. Yes?
And, I mean, I was not that committed. I mean, you're arguing now only in terms of the eigenvalues, or maybe in terms of the eigenvalues.
Sure.
I mean, what you're actually getting, I mean, with all of these errors, is kind of, let's say, probability distribution for matrices. And then you know, well, if those matrices are supposed to be states, they need to be positive, and so therefore you throw them away. That is, you can't negative one. But, I mean, you will have lots of different matrices with the same spectrum. And so kind of, since you were arguing with these probabilities, I mean, let's say uniform distribution among that matrices doesn't necessarily give you uniform distribution among spectra. So therefore, I mean, I'm feeling a little bit concerned about translation between density matrices or not density matrices and positive and negative spectra. Does this really, I mean, your identification kind of respect probability?
The point here is to talk about the uncertainty in rho. And you're quite right that uncertainty in rho does not correspond directly to uncertainty in the eigenvalues of rho. I could, for instance, be entirely certain that rho is a pure state, in which case I know the eigenvalues perfectly. But I don't know what rho is, right? It could be any pure state. So I can't make a one-to-one correspondence between uncertainty about the eigenvalues and uncertainty about the density matrix. But what I can say is that if I'm quite uncertain about the density matrix, then it is unjustifiable to say that the probability for something is 0. And the 0 eigenvalue does correspond to the 0 probability for something. So that's, again, I'm not trying to draw a precise connection here. What I'm trying to do is point out that if we have these 0 eigenvalues, it indicates that there's something suspicious about what we're concluding from our data.
No, but I mean, I'd say in realistic terms, it's always like that. You say, well, you have a very small probability, and then you say, well, that's probably roughly 0 or so. And I mean, now you say, well, it is possible to have this state where your largest eigenvalue is not 0.7, as you assume, but 0.3 or so. My question is, like, what? How small is this probability? I mean, of course, they can't rule it out with mathematical precision. I mean, with their measurement, they will have some probability that they actually had that.
Can we take this discussion offline because I have a limited amount of time?
Yeah. Sorry.
Carlos, can I ask you a quick question?
Yeah.
What would you say for a system that has an infinite number of moons, say like a harmonic oscillator?
At the moment, nothing. There's nothing that I can say that won't take more than 45 minutes to say about
that.
So, for now, I want to talk about finite dimensional systems. Okay, so the question I want to ask is, how did we get here? So let me take you on a whirlwind tour of how we ended up in this situation. I hope that this will explicate what's going wrong a little bit. First of all, let me take you all the way back to the beginning of state estimation and tomography. Basic idea of tomography, if you're not familiar with it, is that we're going to assume that the probability of observing some POVM effect, M sub I, is just the number of times that we observe it divided by the total number of measurements that we make. This makes sense, it's relative frequency. The probability then gives us the expectation value of that operator, the expectation values together for several measurements, uniquely identify the density matrix. So what we do is, for instance, I take a qubit, I'm going to draw a lot of pictures of block spheres because it's the only state space that I can draw. But actually, I can't even draw that, so I'm just going to draw a lot of pictures of block circles, where the sigma y dimension or the sigma z dimension is going to be inferred. So this is a cross section of the block sphere. And what I'm imagining we've done here is we've taken some true state, which I didn't know, it's black dot. And now I've measured sigma z 10 times, and I got 9 ups, which is entirely plausible. I then measured sigma x 10 times, I got 9 pluses. And I drew the straight lines corresponding to those expectation values. The problem, of course, is that I end up half the time, or some fraction of the time, with a point that is outside of the block sphere. It's a negative density matrix. So why did this go wrong? Well, first of all, I equated frequencies, observed frequencies, with probabilities, which is certainly not the case. It's just an estimate of it. These observables aren't truly independent in some sense, in that there are boundary conditions that constrain them. So in a weird sense, they're only independent of each other deep inside the block sphere. Once I get out to the interesting regime of pure states, they're no longer strictly independent. So this was known, that tomography gives you negative states, and the fix for it is called maximum likelihood estimation. I referred to this before. The idea is that you're going to report the state that makes the observed data the most likely. And this, at least, is a coherent, well-understood statistical principle. Been used ever since the early 1900s. It's quite simple. You simply write down this likelihood function, which is the probability of observing what you observe given row. This is just the product of a whole bunch of Born's rule identities. And then you maximize over all the valid states row. You could be parameterizing by their square roots or something like this. And this was introduced for quantum state estimation back in 1997. So how maximal likelihood works. Let me give you an example. This is going to be the simplest example I can come up with. And we're trying to estimate the bias of a coin. I flip the coin once. I get heads. Based on that, the likelihood function as a function of p, the probability of heads, is just a straight line. The higher I say p is, the more likely I was to get the result that I observed, which was heads. So here's my likelihood function. It's a straight line. If I pick the maximum of it, I'm going to report p equals 1. This might be considered a little bit unjustified based on the fact that I've only flipped the coin once. So I don't seem to be hedging my bets at all. Slightly more complicated example, if I get 9 heads and 1 tail, here's the likelihood function. I pick my peak right here. So this is an example. Let me give you an example for quantum states. Again, I'm going to draw one of these block circles. So this is just what we saw before. The example was tomography. In this case, where I've gotten 9 ups and 10 downs, 9 pluses and 1 minus, the likelihood function has contours that look like this. Now, what I want to point out is, if you look at these contours, you'll notice that the unconstrained likelihood function defined on a block cube or block square, since I've taken a cross section, has a maximum right at the tomographic result. This is always true. Since the maximum of the unconstrained likelihood is outside the block sphere, and the likelihood function is quasi-convex, you can just sort of crawl up the likelihood towards the maximum until you reach the border of the set of positive states. And because the unconstrained maximum is outside, the constrained maximum is always going to be on the border. Which is why whenever you have a negative tomographic estimate, you end up with a rank division maximum likelihood estimate. We can't actually say anything about the relative number of eigenvalues. I've tried. It turns out to be a difficult problem. Numerical experiments indicate that generally you get approximately the same number of zeros when you estimate a large state as tomography would give you negatives. Sometimes you get a few more. We've never observed less. I'm still trying to come up with a contrived example where you can get less. But you'll always get at least one zero probability. So the point is, broadly speaking, maximum likelihood takes all your negative eigenvalues and it replaces them with zeros. It's a sort of a minimal fix for tomography. So what's going on here? Here's the really, really short version. This is the part where I'm hoping the foundations people will not bring up complicated terms. Maximum likelihood is a really good way of fitting the data. In fact, this has been pointed out in several papers that it minimizes the relative entropy between the state and the data that you actually observe. It predicts what you've already seen really well. That's not necessarily the same as predicting the future, unless you accept what I'm going to call the frequentist axiom, which is the future, statistically, will look just like the past. classically, this is rather interesting, this is always at least plausible. It might not look like the past, but it's possible that the future will look like the past. You can't rule it out. Here's something quite odd. The quantum mechanics, again, I like the same example. When I end up with a state that's over here, based on my likelihood function, I've only measured sigma x and sigma z. And as a result, I end up predicting zero probability for one outcome of this measurement, this outcome down here. I predicted zero probability for something that I never even bothered to measure. So maximum likelihood assigns p equals zero to events that were never observed, not. This seems odd. And it occurs because the frequentist axiom is something that you can violate at will, you can falsify in the context of quantum state estimation. All you have to do is come along and measure some observable that nobody ever measured before, or that the estimator didn't measure. In which case, the future is definitely not going to look like the past because it contains an entirely different set of events. That's sort of as far down the foundations road as I'm going to go for right now. Since I'm running out of time, let me see if I can move on. Give me the foundation. Pardon?
Go to a
I apologize for your lunch. I'm going to try to break here. Let me introduce quantum scoring rules, which is rather neat formalism. This is going to give us a foundation for answering the question, how should we do this? In other words, I don't want to try to fix the procedure. I want to just go back to basic principles and figure out how we ought to do it. Okay. Now, the paper that we wrote on this, we tried to compress the heck out of it to get a nice four-page paper, so it's rather dense, and so I'm going to do the same thing in this talk. Feel free, if you don't want to follow the math, to just sort of cross your eyes at this point and just follow the basic concepts if you want, or you can check my math along the way. Here's the basic concept. States are predictions, nothing more, nothing less. A quantum state predicts the outcome of future measurements. So if we want to measure how good an estimate is, we should ask, how well does it predict measurements on state, the system's preparedness unknown state? So I'm going to try to define a metric that will measure how good an estimate sigma is of an unknown state rho. And I'm going to base it on this idea of state as a prediction. And I'm going to have two criteria. The first, and I hope these are unarguable, the first is the best estimate of rho ought to be rho itself. In other words, if there is somebody who knows what rho is, that really ought to be the best estimate. Otherwise, we run into some very weird problems. The second is that I want this to be operational, because I want to be able to actually have conversations with experimentalists. I don't want to say, well, here's some neat abstract metric. And they go, what's the metric? And I say, oh, triangle inequality. And they say, where's the button that I push to measure this? I want something that you can push a button and you can measure, because otherwise you're not really good at physics. So this operational test should correspond to somebody's utility, reward, or cost for some practical procedure, something that has some meaning in an experiment. This leads to what we call quantum strictly proper scoring rules. The details are available at that preprint number. This is work of Patrick Hayden. So let me try to go through the derivation very quickly. Here's the basic idea. You have made an estimate of a state rho. That estimate is sigma. We introduce Victor, the verifier, who's going to come along and he's going to measure a copy of rho. He's going to pay you a reward that depends on what outcome I, he got, and your estimate, sigma. Victor's goal is to motivate you to tell the truth if you know rho exactly. I only care about the case where you actually know what rho is. But we'll get to the case where you don't know later on. Your goal is to maximize your expected reward. So you don't know exactly what you're going to get, because quantum mechanics is probabilistic. But you do some calculations in your greedy little head, and you figure out what your best strategy is for maximizing this. So I'm going to define this metric that I'm looking for as your expected reward. You expect to get from Victor over all possibilities for reporting sigma of the true state is pro. Okay? So how does this work out? Well, Victor's going to make some measurement which has outcomes E sub I. And F is just going to be the average over the probability of getting I times the reward given I. Very simple. And so I can write this, in fact, as the trace of the true state, which I don't know, times some reward operator that depends on sigma. It's just a sum of the VODN elements times their reward values. And I'm going to define the value of a given state as the most money that you could possibly make off of that state. So it's the reward for telling the truth, if you will. OK, setting that aside, I'm going to impose my second requirement. Actually, this was my first requirement. The reward for telling the truth should be greater than the reward for lying, for every lie. So this is going to place a constraint on what these reward operators can be. This is sort of the only technical bit of this, and it's not very technical. I'm going to demand that f of rho and rho has to be greater than f of rho given sigma for any sigma that's not the true state. I do a little bit of algebraic manipulation on this involving just adding the value of sigma to either side. And I get an inequality, which is that the value of rho had better be bigger than the value of sigma plus a linear function of rho and sigma. So to figure out how this constrains my reward, let me draw a picture. Here's my g of rho. Of course, this is defined on some big multidimensional state space, but I'm going to try to squash it down to a line because, again, that's all I can draw. Here's my g of rho. Here's the point sigma. And here, the red dotted line is this linear bit on the right side of the equation. I've already violated my constraint in this picture. And the reason is that on one side, g of rho is bigger than the linear approximation. On the other side, it's not. And so I violated this for sigma on one side. We can't have that. So this constraint means that this linear approximation has to be a subtangent to g of rho, basically a tangent line. This constrains my reward operator to be the gradient of the value function. But you notice that I'm also violating it in this case. Even though I'm locally satisfying the inequality, there's a violation over here. In fact, the only way to satisfy this inequality globally is to demand that g of rho be strictly convex. If it's not, then there's some point where you can't define a subtangent that's completely underneath the function. And these two constraints turn out to be completely sufficient. So you pick any strictly convex g of rho, define r to be its gradient, which gives you that this metric is a subtangent to it. And that gives you a procedure for that Victor can use to guarantee the experimentalist's honesty. So to summarize, the estimator gets an expected loss if he lies, which is just the difference between the most that the estimator could make and how much he actually makes. This is something we call an operational divergence. It tells you how bad your estimate is, how much money you would lose. What's nice is that these are in a one-to-one relationship with strictly convex entropy functions. Any strictly convex function of states is basically an entropy. One example is, in fact, the regular one-element entropy itself. I'll give you another example in just a moment. But you pick an entropy, I will give you an operational divergence, which tells you how bad a state estimate is, and I will give you a procedure for going to the lab and testing out various state estimates. For the experimentalists in the room, there's a paper in preparation right now on exactly how to do that, how to make this a concrete proposal. This is not some vague thing you could do in a couple of decades. This is something you can do next week, at least try to get the paper done. So that's rather cute, because it relies on virtually nothing. It allows you to take two different estimators who think that they have a good idea what the state is and say, well, I have no idea what the state is, but I'm going to do an experiment which will tell me which one of you did a better job. And it doesn't rely on actually figuring out the state in the first place, which is rather cute. Okay, that's all I'm going to say about that, because, of course, this is Perimeter Institute, so back to theory. Survey of metrics. I mentioned that your entropy function could, in fact, be the von Neumann entropy. If you pick the von Neumann entropy, and you go through this mathematical procedure, the operational divergence you get is just the relative entropy, trace of rho log sigma minus log rho. You can also pick as your, quote, entropy function, the purity, or the linear entropy. If you do that, the operational divergence that you get is the LT distance between the two states, rho and sigma. These are by far the best known examples of these scoring rules. You can come up with an infinite number of others, pick any strictly convex function. I don't really know a whole lot about the other options. We're giving you examples of things that aren't operational divergences. One example is the overlap metric. It's just 1 minus trace of rho sigma. This does give you zero if rho and sigma are the same pure state, but it starts to break down if they're mixed states. And in fact, it's not proper. It motivates lying under some circumstances. The best estimate of a mixed state rho is the projector onto the largest eigenvector of rho. That's a lie. Other examples include trace norm distance and the Pedelli. Both of these are not operational. You can't actually write down a procedure that makes these norms into the expected cost or utility of some single shot experiment. And I'll talk a little bit more about this in just a moment. The key thing about operational divergences is they make sense. They were derived from a context in which we are comparing a physical state, which is implement as the state of the system you have in your lab, but you don't know it to write it down. We're comparing that to a classical description, which is something written down on paper. So other metrics, like fidelity, for instance, are designed for comparing physical states to physical states. It tells you how well does this state simulate this state. There are things that are sort of designed for comparing classical states. Relative entropy was previously thought to be one of these. It's defined asymptotically for infinitely many copies of the two states. We've given a single-shot interpretation of relative entropy that allows you to compare a classical description written down on paper to a physical state that you don't even know what it is, you just have access to it. So that is the core of these operational divergences. Okay, as I'm moving on towards my time limit, let me tell you about the solution to this estimation problem. The solution is something called Bayesian mean estimation. The procedure is actually embarrassingly simple. You, instead of being a frequentist and assuming that the future will look like the past, you become a Bayesian. You start with prior distribution over density matrices, then you make a bunch of measurements, you get a likelihood function from those measurements, and you update to get a posterior distribution. And then what you do, and this is maybe the only non-trivial bit here, is you report the mean value of that distribution. So there might be some Bayesians who would say, well, you should do something else with your posterior distribution. What I'm proposing you should do is you should actually report the mean value, but why this is the right thing to do. Intuitively, the difference between this and maximum likelihood is that if you have some likelihood function, I'm assuming a flat measure over probability space here, which you don't have to do. But if you do assume a flat measure, then maximum likelihood tells you to report the mode, the peak of your probability distribution, which could be anywhere. Bayesian tells you to report the mean of your probability distribution, which is always somewhere in the middle of the probability distribution. This gives you a sort of gut feeling for what's going on here. Okay, let me give you a couple of quick demonstrations of how this works and how you do this. This is what I just described. You're going to apply Bayes' rule to get a posterior. An example is a spin 1/2 particle. So let me show you how you would apply this to a qubit. Again, I'm going to ignore one of the three Pauli operators because I can't draw it. The POVM operators are just going to be the BD84 four-state, you know, left, right, plus, minus outcomes. And so here is a probability distribution over a cross-section of the Bloch sphere. And I'm going to show you how you update this as measurement results come trickling in. So first, we're going to start measuring sigma x. And every time I get a result, I mask this by a linear function. But I'm stacking linear functions on top of each other, producting them together. And so I end up with a high-order polynomial. Now I've measured sigma x as many times as I'm going to, I've got this distribution, and now I'm going to start measuring sigma y, and again, this continues to mask my distribution function. And because the boundary conditions are not independent, the final distribution does involve correlation between x and y because of those boundary conditions. So at the end of the day, I have some distribution over states, and the prescription is I should take this distribution and report the mean of it. End of story. Let me survey really briefly the properties of this, and I refer you to the paper that came out last month if you want detailed derivations of these. First is that the estimate that you get is strictly positive. You never get zero eigenvalues, subject to a very, very weak condition on the prior, which is weaker than any sane person, any sane experimenter would ever apply. The proof sketch is this. Suppose that your prior has support on some measurable set of states. For instance, the surface of the Bloch sphere, that are not orthogonal to a given state. So for any psi, the prior contains a measurable set of states that are not orthogonal to it. Then as you go through, each measurement is going to remove a measure zero set of states from the support. Example of that, let's see, chalk. If talking about the blocks here. And let's say I, so I've got a probability distribution that's defined over here. If I observe up, that only rules out one state, which is down. All the rest of them are still possible. So every time you make a measurement, you chop out a tiny little measure zero negligible point. You still have support on all the rest of the states, which means at the end of the day, your distribution contains states that are not orthogonal to any given state. And so the average over all those states is also not orthogonal. Second advantage that I'm really not going to talk about very much, you get three error bars with every estimate. This doesn't happen in maximum likelihood. There's a procedure for computing error bars that turns out actually not to work in certain cases. Here, you always get a very natural set of error bars. Again, in black sphere, it's going to be some sort of an error ellipsoid around the actual estimate. You can compute it very straightforwardly. You just take the second moment of your distribution. End of story. And the other point that I want to make is that the reason I presented these quantum strictly proper scoring rules is they provide a route to derive Bayesian mean estimation. The reason is Bayesian mean estimation unconditionally optimizes every operational divergence. This includes relative entropy, includes the L2 distance. It doesn't include some other metrics. And without presenting the entire proof, because, well, it's too long, the key fact here is that if you don't know what the state is, you say, well, it could be all these various states. Then because f of rho and sigma is linear in rho, no, not the operational divergence. That was the value minus the reward. The reward itself is linear, which means that I can take this average in my I don't know what the state is, and I can just propagate it right through, and I can say that my expected reward is the reward between the expected state and my estimate. Which means, of course, that I want my estimate to be the expected state. And that's essentially how this proof goes. So this is actually an amazingly powerful result. It goes through for finite numbers of measurements, which was not true of any of the proofs of optimality for other state estimation procedures, essentially because they're frequentist approaches. And in a frequentist approach, you can't say anything except about n equals infinity. So for every operational divergence, if you have a good prior, you can unconditionally optimize it by using this procedure. Of course, you'll never have a good prior, but you might be able to get a pretty good prior based on things you know about physics. Let me just point out, you might say, well, isn't this mean, reporting the mean of the distribution, an obvious choice? Well, no, it's not actually that trivial. Suppose that instead of picking one of these operational divergences that we derived via scoring rules, we try to optimize fidelity instead, which is what about 90% of the papers on quantum state estimation try to do, because everybody likes fidelity. Suppose that I know that the true state is either up or plus. Then the average of those two states, the average of my distribution, is of course this mixed state in the middle. But, well, the fidelity between that state and, sorry, the average fidelity between that state and the true state, depending on which branch I'm in, is 3/4. And I can beat that by reporting the largest eigenvector of that. So if I had tried to optimize fidelity, I would have not gotten Bayesian mean estimation. And furthermore, I would have gotten a recommendation to report a pure state that I know is not the true state. I would have predicted zero probability for this measurement outcome, which is completely yes. So this is why we went all the way back to ground zero and built up this framework of scoring rules, was so that we would not have to worry about this ever happening to us. The moral of this is that fidelity is not the right thing to use in this context. Suppose I went back and I assumed the frequentist axiom. The future will look like the past. Well, then I can do something really nasty. I know what the future is going to look like. So I can project myself forward into the future after I've made a lot more measurements, because I know what all the rest of my measurements will look like, even though I haven't made them yet. And as a result, I can basically take my likelihood function, I can exponentiate it to a very high power, because I just observe the same thing over and over again. And at the end of the day, my likelihood becomes a delta function on its maximum. And this allows you to derive maximum likelihood. So I guess the moral of this is that you can get maximum likelihood by assuming something that's rather insane. So that's not an indictment of maximum likelihood, but it might make you scratch your head a little bit. I'm going to skip over the question of how we actually do this. We're doing this in simulations. We use the Metropolis Hastings method. You hop around covert space in an intelligent way. And finally, I want to present in conclusion a couple of concrete results where we tested this. We said, okay, theoretically, this should work really well. How well does it work in practice, or at least in numerical simulations, compared with maximum likelihood? So, here's our numerical procedure. It's pretty much what you would expect. We generate some random states according to some measure. In this case, it was Hilbert-Schmidt measure, which is flat over operator space. And then we compare the results that we get from using maximum likelihood to the results that we get from using Bayesian. This is joint work with Karen Malhotra, our search student. And we use several different metrics to compare the true state, which we know because, well, theorists, to the estimate that we get. We use relative entropy and L2 distance, which I pointed out were operational divergences, and so we sort of know that Bayesian should be optimal for this. We also did trace distance and fidelity, which were the ones that I pointed out that we don't know that Bayesian is optimal for. The punchline of all this data, in each case, these are distances, except for fidelity, which is the 1 minus fidelity is a sort of a distance. Red is maximum likelihood, green is Bayesian. So the distance, according to relative entropy, is huge for maximum likelihood and quite small for Bayesian. According to L2 distance, there's a less noticeable gap, but still about a factor of 2 improvement over maximum likelihood. Trace distance, another noticeable gap. Fidelity, we get substantially higher fidelity using Bayesian and maximum likelihood. So the conclusion is, yes, as expected, we do better using Bayesian for the operational divergences. And, oh, this is nice, even for the things that we couldn't prove that we were optimal for, we still are doing better. And let me conclude with a little bit of a surprise. We threw in, just out of curiosity, something called quick and dirty tomography. And this is because both MLE and Bayesian are computationally difficult, which gives the folks doing 8-qubit or state estimation over Innsbruck real headaches. It takes them a week just to run state analysis. So here's something that's really easy. You do tomography, you get some negative eigenvalues, then you just chop those out, you set them to zero, which gives you a positive state. It's got zeros in it, but hey, so does maximum likelihood. And then you renormalize it. And we want to say, well, how well does this work? Here was the surprising thing. For 1, 2, and 3 qubits, this is all L2 distance. We found that at 1, Bayesian is slightly better than both maximum likelihood and positivized tomography. For 2, a gap opens up, and positivized tomography is actually better than maximum likelihood. And for 3, it's starting to get substantial. We still don't fully understand this. We were quite surprised by this. A quick and dirty ad hoc method that takes about 5 minutes beats the pants off of maximum likelihood, which takes a week. Check back later. We're still trying to figure this out. I guess the point is, you really shouldn't trust maximum likelihood. I mean, if you can't even beat something that sucks. So the conclusions, I guess, are, in my opinion, it's worth thinking rather hard about this problem that maybe didn't look interesting in the first place because you find some interesting practical and theoretical results. These story rules are rather a neat framework for comparing multiple estimates with reliable and experimentally relevant way. This Bayesian stuff, well, being a Bayesian is wonderful. It's an optimal procedure. It's sort of slow, but what would be interesting would be to take off on this and try to do good approximations based on that foundation. Oh, and by the way, these quick and dirty methods actually aren't as dirty as you might have thought. Thank you very much.
So unless there's some pretty urgent question, I suggest we end the conference now and talk over at lunch downstairs. Well, so thanks for coming. This is, I guess, the last talk conclusion of the Young Researcher Conference. Well, thanks for coming. Thank you.